Welcome to the True Blue LA podcast, and hello and welcome to 2020. I'm Hugh Downs. With me, as always, is Barbara Walters, also known as Eric Steven. How's it going?
How do I say goodbye to what we had?
This is just the new, it's going to be a musical podcast.
That's right.
This year.
We're taking over where Pump Up the Jam left off, and there it is.
So we recorded last, I think, three and a half weeks ago. Nothing has happened since in terms of the Dodgers roster, but we lost some friends. Some articles have been written. Some people have been interviewed. We're going to talk about all of that after this.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
I couldn't cram it into the intro, but you and I actually hung out for a little bit. Over the New Year, on New Year's Day, exactly.
That's right. We wanted to wait till the new year, the new decade, to get our sort of our meetup in, and so yeah, we couldn't do it in 2019. That would have been weird. But yeah, 2020, we started off the right way with delicious dim sum, and it was wonderful.
I'm always surprised that because we went to Alhambra for it. I was visiting my folks, and. I thought you were going to throw in on my folks.
No, come on. Who do you take me for?
Yeah. And I never hit the parade route. I'm always surprised that traffic is always completely clear. Driving on a Wednesday in LA and having completely clear traffic is great. But on top of that, having to be the parade day, thank goodness it's a holiday, I guess.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things, like, unless you're literally going within a few blocks of the parade, the Rose Parade in Pasadena, then you're going to find the most empty roads possible. Like, the entire, like, I'd say maybe a week to 2 week period in LA around Christmas and New Year's is, like, it's a ghost town because a lot of people leave. And, like, in terms of just traffic, like, it's wonderful, and it's a welcome respite. As someone who works from home, I barely went anywhere. I went to Orange County for, like, a few days around Christmas, but other than that, didn't really drive much, so I didn't get to experience the wonderful lack of traffic, but it is a neat phenomenon.
Normally, I wouldn't banter too hard at the start of an episode. That's probably a lie. We do it all the time. But I was thinking, oh, we should move on to the news. There's no news. The Dodgers are going to have two, I think, beloved players not on their roster next year. That's going to be the main thing we talk about. Both starting pitchers, Hyunjin Ryu and Rich Hill, gone to teams in the American League.
That's right. It's funny. Like, so we specifically... because of the holidays and some traveling schedule, this is 3 weeks after we last recorded it, as opposed to our normal sort of off-season schedule of two. And, you know, it's just like...
We did it because I was in LA, and it's hard to record when I'm not at my home recording setup. But we joked that we were giving Friedman and Co. more time to make a move. Not just a big move. Any move. Additive move, I should say.
Well, for a good, I guess for a small portion of time, I'm trying to remember the exact timing of this. But like, it seemed like JT Chargois getting released to sign with the Japanese team was going to be the main topic. but I think it actually happened after Ryu, so maybe that's not the case. But it's just like, that's the level of, like, anything, let's make it happen. And well, and it, as you know, as much as it would have been weird to, like, set up a record at our table. There was just no room on the table because we ordered so much food. I literally knocked over my hot tea and my water at one point because, well, A, I'm a clumsy person, and B, we just needed room, and like in scrambling to find room for other dishes.
Did you have any of the chicken feet?
I didn't try the chicken feet. I ate just about everything else.
I knew I had my last In-N-Out trip for a while ahead of me, so I ate a little bit lighter than everyone else.
Oh, I was going to say, so you waited to have chicken feet till you went to In-N-Out? What? No, yeah.
Yeah, that's new specialty.
It's a secret menu item.
Give me animal style.
So yeah, you can actually pick the animal. That's the new animal style. Okay, so back to the Dodgers or the former Dodger stuff. Now, you could on one hand you could say both Hyunjin Ryu and Rich Hill were excellent pitchers, like for the Dodgers. Whether like what you can count on from them in 2020 specifically, like is up for grabs, I would say. And like, I guess there's you could make an argument like, okay, Ryu got 4 years and $80 million from the Blue Jays.
We really should mention this. I am nailed.
Oh, is that what I don't see? This is like my memory is mush, as you know.
So I was that's on a plane and I was on Southwest, and Southwest gives you free messaging. So I can text. I was able to you text messaged me some stupid pun, and I said, I don't know what you're talking about. I don't have the internet because I didn't want to pay the $8 just for my phone. And you said that Ryu had signed, and you asked me to guess the contract, and I nailed 480.
You said 480, and it was one of those things like where in a weird way, it's you want to do like a joke, you want to hope that someone will guess something so outlandish so you can say, no, it was even more than that, foolish answer, and you you nailed it on the first try, and I believe my response to you was, fuck you.
It was.
Yeah, and because I was like, there's no way you don't have internet. And you're like, no, I'm on the plane. I'm like, and this has happened before. We've texted. I've texted you in the air. That's how we usually communicate. So, congrats to you for doing that.
I'm sad we didn't record it earlier. I have no proof except for our...
We should just have Siri like say out loud our text messages. Okay. And then, there'd be a lot of cussing. It'll be like, duck you. What? No. Siri, don't autocorrect, damn it. But yeah, so 4 years, $80 million, that's a lot of money. Like, it's his age 33 to 36 seasons. It's understandable, right? Like, certainly 2020, he was just runner-up Cy Young. He was very good in 2018, missed a lot of time with his groin tearing off of his bone. Like, I can't get over that, how painful that must have been. But like, when he's on the mound, like this is the sort of the through line for both pitchers is when they're on the mound, wonderful. It's just how often you get him on the mound. Ryu was more reliable in this last year than he was since like his first 2 years in LA. So that was great. You know, again, it's a large outlay. Understandable they didn't do that in a vacuum, right? Like completely understandable. They weren't going to go that high for Ryu. So you get it, right? But at the same time, you're like, but on some level, whether or not you wanted sort of Ryu for like 2020, it's still like
an arm. You need arm, like right. That's all pitchers have these. Even if certainly Hill and potentially Ryu have a bigger question mark than other pitchers, you still need arms because your best laid plans are going to go awry on at least one of your guys. And right now, and we'll get to this a little bit later in the show, the Dodgers plans, like a guy who hasn't actually started it since he was 19, a pile of rookies, and then a pitcher that they like to convert into a reliever right around August. That's right. Scary. And we'll talk about that later. But yeah, I think, I think most fans are on the bargain of like, why haven't the Dodgers done anything here? I don't think they're like, oh, we'll be fine. Ryu's hurt. What's the worst that could happen? And that's why if you recall previous episodes, these were the two to me most obvious Dodger offseason moves. There was the pie in the sky that they would sign one of the big free agents. There's a still possible, but maybe not so likely, that they're going to make a big trade. And then there was we'll bring back Ryu, we'll bring back Rich Hill. Rich Hill can pitch in the playoffs. We can just focus him entirely on that. That struck me as a very move this front office would make, and neither got made. And there's not a lot left to do other than this sort of fabled big trade that could happen.
Yeah, like, so we'll, it's weird, like, this winter, like, so the last two off seasons were pretty quiet in terms of, like, major free agents. Obviously, last year we ended up with getting Machado and Harper getting their $300 million plus deals. But that at the end, right? So, like, and then, but, and, like, we knew this winter that, like, Steven Strasburg and Garrett Cole were going to sign like humongous deals. We knew Cole was going to sign a record contract, or at least it looked that way. And then like, and we knew Strasburg was going to sign a very big deal. I don't think I expected him to get like the presumed Cole record deal, right? Like going into this offseason, 7-245 is like a pipe dream for a pitcher, right? In this day and age. And Strasburg got that at 2 years older than Cole. Still awesome. And then Cole went and got a nine-year deal from the Yankees. And so, like, they blew those records out of the water. But I think even more than that, like, Zach Wheeler got his huge deal, 5 years, 118. Who is the other pitcher I'm missing? This is a tragedy. So Madison Bumgarner signed 585. So not quite the man, this is bumming me out. I'm trying to remember it without looking it up. I'm just gonna look it up. But like my point is like Ryu Yeah, you totally did. Like this is like this. Okay, so in total value, Ryu was fifth. In average value, he was fourth among pitchers. Like this offseason. So the point I was trying to make is that like these deals were rare the last two offseasons. Like there's been six pitcher contracts 4 or more years this winter. There were five the last two offseasons combined. So like that's sort of that's more the surprising part. I'll say this about Ryu. He was one of their more like successful, like one of the most successful offseason or international signings ever of any team, I would say. I think people forget this. Like he was actually one of the best pitchers in the National League, like before his shoulder surgery. Like, okay. Mm-hmm. So on one level, his ERA plus was 111, right? In those first 2 years, 317 ERA, like, okay, that's fine. He was actually 12th in the National League with that ERA. But if you look at it, like, the peripherals were excellent. Like, 297 FIP, that was 4th in the National League in those first 2 years. Clayton Kershaw, Adam Wainwright, Cliff Lee were the only two better. His 7.8 Fangraphs WAR was tied for 7th. Like, look at this way. Those were Greinke's first 2 years in L.A., and Greinke was at 7.9. So, like, Ryu was, like, excellent. And then obviously, he had the huge like shoulder surgery. Then he had elbow cleanup, so he basically missed 2 years. He was like one of the best pitchers, not only nationally but in baseball, the last few years, even better than we could have imagined. I would say like coming back, I thought 2017 was like a major win for Ryu. He had missed 2 years. The fact that he was just a like serviceable and like very good starter, but also not good enough to make the postseason rotation. He was the odd man out behind Kershaw, Hill, Ryu Darvish, and Alex Wood. So, like, he was sort of in that, like, Kenta Maeda limbo now, except that Ryu can't really pitch in relief. So, like, but the fact that he made it back to that after that, like, humongous, like, you know, time missed, like, that was a win to me. And then, like, I did not see these last 2 years coming. So, like, maybe the Dodgers figured, like, that was just sort of gravy, right? Like, what we got from him was excellent. We can't really double down on that. So on some level, I understand it. I'll say this. Ryu's overall postseason ERA is 405. Generally, he's been fine. He had a couple shaky starts, like, in 2018 against Milwaukee and his one start in the World Series, but there's three starts I wanted to remember. So 2013 NLCS, Dodgers were down 0-2, including a 1-0 game in St. Louis. They come back home, absolutely, obviously have to win game three. He pitched 7 shutout innings. That was his first year with the Dodgers. 2014 NLCS, same situation, game three, except this time it was tied? Yeah, it was tied 1-1. He actually pitched awesome in game three, 6 innings, one run given up. But he did this after missing he had not pitched in 24 days prior to that. He was like sort of – like there was like this mystical thing about him almost like those first couple years where he didn't throw in between starts. Everyone throws like a bullpen session or whatever to get prepared. He's like, nah, that's not what I do. And they're like, hey, if it works, like keep doing what you're doing. And like he would also almost have situations where sometimes he didn't go on a rehab assignment. And like since the minor league season was over, he didn't really have an opportunity to do that. So he went like he had shoulder inflammation at the beginning of September, didn't pitch for 24 days. And his first time on a mound is game three of the NLCS. And he pitched great. The Dodgers ended up losing that game because shockingly, they didn't hit in a postseason series. They got eliminated in. And this was we didn't realize how much of a trend this would become. But this is sort of a thing. And then in the 2000 NLDS against the Braves, he started game one, and this was like really the first time that Kershaw was not given the game one start when available. Like the old, so he had started 8 of the previous 10 game ones, Kershaw. The only 2 times he didn't was right after pitching on short rest in the NLDS, so he wasn't available on a reasonable schedule to pitch game one. So he had basically he was their you know their locked in game one starter. This time both Kershaw and Ryu were rested and they could have flipped the rotation order to like sort of keep that up and they said nope we're sticking with Ryu. Went game one and he pitched 7 shutout innings. Kershaw actually did very well in game two and they won that too. And then Kershaw pitched game one in the later 2 series. But I think that was sort of a nice little symbolic thing and it, like show that they're at least willing to, on some level to. Think outside the box and not treat like Kershaw like this sort of exalted thing that you're always sort of like chasing the dragon with him in a way. I so that was sort of symbolic. But anyway, Ryu was excellent. And like understand $80 million, completely get it that he was like not re-signed. But then. We've talked about this like I think probably every podcast like this off season like Rich Hill seemed like the perfect like obvious situation that the Dodgers would be like well look he's a guy who's not going to be ready till June or July. He's going to pitch half a season. The whole thing with Hill is you love what he does when he's on the mound. It's just getting him on the mound. Yeah. So as long as he's healthy for October.
Try out all these young arms, see if he sticks, and then you have an arm for the playoffs. And if someone had like swooped in, figured out that was something they want, signed him before, say, the Garrett Coles of the world sign, okay, I kind of get it. You're reserving those funds for a big splash. He signed afterwards. What are they saving this money for? And you know... They can keep saying, oh, trades are possible. You know, we're going to, you know, we need that money for Mookie or something like that. It's like, I'll believe it when I see it.
Yeah, I was so surprised at this. Like, he signed $3 million guarantee with the Twins. And you're like, of all the things, right, that if you want to, like, ding the Dodgers for, like, being too cheap or sticking under the salary cap, that's the exact kind of contract you want, right? Like, very limited guarantee. He has $9.5 million in incentives if he hits – like 15 starts and 75 innings, you would completely love to pay Rich Hill $12.5 million if he was able to pitch that, right? Like, that would be perfect. Sort of surprising. Like, everyone in the clubhouse loves Rich Hill. Like, he was in tears, like, at the end of the NLDS this year because of how hard he started game four after, like, what, his ankle, I think he was dealing with, or his knee. I think it was his knee. And that was after like a partial tear in his UCL. So like that shows you how desperate like the need is to have like playoff starters, you know, and like Ryu and Hill were definitely playoff starters. Like they started 9 of the 21 playoff games, the Dodgers, the last 2 years. In the regular season, those two combined for 81 starts and a 2.66 ERA. the last 2 years. So, again, not that they're going to put up a 2.6 ERA in 2020, but that's what you have to replace, right, going forward. And so, and that's where the tough spot comes in. I will say this about Hill. Again, like Ryu, excellent when he pitched. He had a 3.16 ERA with the Dodgers. Okay, so Ryu had a 1.29 ERA plus among Dodgers with 100 starts. He was fourth all time with that 1.29. Kershaw is 1.57. Kevin Brown's 1.47. Koufax is 1.31. Everybody else is lower than Ryu. Like, he's actually tied with Dazzy Vance and Andy Messersmith. So, look, ERA plus is not the end-all be-all, but it's a metric, right? Like, Rich Hill is I lowered it to 50 starts because Rich Hill only made, like, what? I think it was 68 starts with the Dodgers. So, I'll say this. Oh, okay. I have this is funny. I thought, okay, I had two different trivia questions I was going to ask you, and I'm skipping ahead. Okay, so since I'm talking about this now, I'm going to, yeah. All right, here's the deal. Okay, so, oh yeah, among 50 starts, Ryu is tied for sixth with his 129 ERA plus. Rich Hill tied for ninth. Can you, I'm trying to think how I'm going to phrase this. Can you name any other members of the top 10?
So this is minimum 50 starts by ERA plus.
I've already given you Kershaw, Kevin Brown, and Koufax. You know Ryu and Hill are there. So there are five other members of the top 10.
Is this...
Oh, I guess I gave you two others. Andy Messersmith and Dazzy Vance.
Oh,
tied with Ryu. See, you only have to name three pitchers, minimum 50 starts, in the top 10 of ERA plus in Dodger history.
Okay. So this is what we're going to do. This lines up well. We have to take a break. I'm going to think, and we'll come back. We won't have any dead air, and I'll have three guesses for you. How about that?
Yeah, you can all, you know, just have two.
Two?
Okay,
I'll have two guesses for you right for this.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Okay, we're back.
Yay.
So I've got two guesses. I went because I should know this as the master of small sample size. 50 innings is small enough that you don't want to risk the guys that are known for their highlights because they might have been on the team for a while and tanked it. So
I'll say, okay.
Don't say anything because one was on the Dodgers for a while. So right. my first guess is Zach Greinke.
Zach Greinke is second to Clayton Kershaw. His ERA plus is 1.56 in 92 starts.
Okay. And then now I am going to go with kind of a long timer, but I'm hoping here. Don Drysdale.
No. Drysdale is tied for 15th at 121 in a mere 465 starts.
Yeah.
Okay, so my hint to you is going to be both of the there's actually three. We're going to talk about the third one later. He's the Dodger Rewind. But the other two, Greinke and this other person, both had fewer than 100 but more than 50 starts.
I'm not going to go then.
And I will say the other one that I was going to get to is currently active and started game one of the playoffs last year for the Dodgers. Walker Buehler's he's at 130. So
wow. I guess I would have pegged him just under 50 starts. So,
right, and it's one of those things. You're like, oh yeah, okay. I guess he has made that. So he's at 53 starts.
Yeah, okay. I'm happy with my guesses then.
so way to be way off. No, I'm just kidding. Okay. So I will say this: the best thing about Hill, right? Like, well, look, he was wonderful to watch, right? Like the nicest guy ever. And also on the mound, he was a hellion. Like he was so like passionate and like ferocious. It was, and like he was excellent in his playoff starts, but like he's always going to be like, he's lumped in with like some of the major like decision making like of the last year that's gotten the most like criticism, I would say. But he, look, 2.70 ERA in 11 postseason starts and 12 games with the Dodgers. Relief appearance was mop up one scoreless inning in the World Series in 18. Okay, so he only has one win in those games. Part of it is because he gets pulled.
Yeah.
Part of it is because bullpens have just completely crapped the bed, like afterwards in some cases. But also, okay, so I would say – so there's the two games that were like – that are most brought up with Hill. The first one was game two of the 2017 World Series, right? He pitched four innings. He struck out seven. He allowed one run. And he also walked three and allowed three hits. He was pulled. It was part of the lineup where they had a bunch of righties in a row. I think it was five righties in a row, and that was Kenta Maeda's role. And then, of course, the Dodgers ended up losing that game. In part because Kenley Jansen had to pitch two innings instead of one, and ended up blowing the game in the ninth. And then they ran out of bullets at the end. They Josh Fields had one of the worst relief appearances of all time in extra innings, and then Randy McCarthy lost it. So that's one thing, right? I will say this in defense of that. I think that's most of that blame still lies on Kenley Jansen. He should have protected that lead and not grooved a pitch to Marwin Gonzalez. But, there's also like, oh, how do you pull Rich Hill? He only gave up one run in four innings. He struck out seven. He also was very lucky. That was the game where there was that diving play by Chris Taylor in the outfield, and the ball ricocheted off of his cap, and that was like, and it like went right to the Dodgers were like able to field it like immediately after that, rather than like scamper away and like get a run. Like that was a run, like that move, like, and then, and it ended up, I think, not scoring. That's how they pitched Rich Hill that year. 2017, like, he was basically two times through the order. That bullpen that year was the best bullpen the Dodgers have had, like, in mm-hmm. recent memory. And like, so they were just like, this is our formula, we're sticking to it. At that point, the Dodgers had lost one playoff game that was their 10th playoff game that year, and they had lost one to that point with a dominant bullpen. So they were relying on that, and that's what just didn't work out. But look at Rich Hill's starts that year. He every time was like it was like his batter's face was 18. I think it was 18, 19, 19, 18 or something. And one of the times he faced the 19th batter was an intentional walk. So it's like, it was pretty clear how they were using him. Right. Like, and then it loosened up in 2018, like they needed him to go longer. And he actually did. He was game four of the 2018 World Series. Dodgers are up 4-0. And then Rich Hill, 6 1/3 innings, right. He had struck out seven again, allowed only one run again. First of all, he had allowed no runs to this point. There was one out and one runner on base. A left-hander, Brock Holt, was up, and so Rich Hill's a left-hander, but they brought in Scott Alexander. However, this was like the exact opposite of the previous year. Rich Hill, remember, like his whole postseason the previous year was like, look, Dave Roberts coming to the mound, he's going to take you out. Roberts' intention in this game, in game four, was to talk to Rich Hill. And Rich Hill, he sees Roberts coming out and starts to walk off the mound and hands him the ball. So Roberts was like, oh, he doesn't want to pitch. And then part of the other reason, too, with Hill is, like, he's, like, very honest about, like, hey, keep an eye on me, take me out, like, if this happens or whatever. Very, like, I would say on the more honest side among most pitchers in terms of telling you how they feel, what they have left, etc. Rich Hill still wanted to pitch in this game. He assumed because Roberts was coming out of the mound, or of the dugout, that he was going to take him out. So that's what he assumed. Robert saw Hill walking off the mound thinking he wants to come out. So this was like this big clusterfuck of confusion. And that caused it. And then this was a thing that, like, of course, like Donald Trump tweeted about it because he's got nothing better to do. And like, come on, right? Like, okay, so that was like the frustrating part about that. And then like every single reliever that came in after that, like, just completely gave it up. And so it was just a disastrous game. That was the game that, like, the Puig home run should have been Puig's defining moment as a Dodger. Could have had a tied series after that with, like, Kershaw going game five. But anyway, what could have been is, like, sort of the story of the Dodgers playoffs in recent years. But anyway, so I looked at his, like, his postseason run with the Dodgers, right? And it's been four seasons. He was only allowed to get more than 15, or he only got more than 15 outs twice. 2016 NLCS game three, he pitched six scoreless innings at home against the Cubs. That was again down 0-2. That put them up 2-1 actually in that series. And then I forgot what happened after that. And then 2018 World Series game four, we talked about. I was looking at his, like, Rich Hill again, who was so injured that he barely pitched in the second half, torn partial tear of his UCL. That's why he's going to miss the first half of the season. Still slated, he still started game four for the Dodgers because he was their best option. And he blasted 2 2/3 innings, right? He only faced 13 batters. He's had like three very weird playoff starts in Washington, D.C. with the Dodgers. In game two, there was a rainout in game two. Usually the NLDS schedule is set up to where you could start. That's why the Dodgers started Kershaw's short rest all the years, because they had Greinke most of the, like, every year but one. And if you have your – you could have your game two starter going game five on regular rest because of the schedule. So that year, the Dodgers didn't have Greinke. They had Rich Hill as their second starter. So when game two got rained out, he had to pitch the next day instead of the scheduled day. And then he ended up starting game five on 3 days rest after Kershaw started game four on 3 days rest. And because Rich Hill had never really done that, wasn't used to it, again, shortened outing 2 2/3. And then the Dodgers bullpened their way to win that one. And so it's just weird. Besides, Rich Hill has the two sort of signature games with the Dodgers. He had the perfect game through seven innings in Miami in 2016, and then was famously pulled by Dave Roberts. And you got to remember the context of this. Like, Rich Hill, he only made six starts with the Dodgers that after getting traded at the deadline that year. He dealt with blisters like for several months, and like their thing was, we have to get him. We just want to make sure he's healthy in October. They weren't going to push him, and so that's sort of why he was pulled there. And then they left him in 2017. The next year, he had a perfect game through eight, and then an error to start the ninth. He had a no-hitter through nine. He started the 10th and then gave up a walk-off home run on like a pop fly to left field, basically, and lost the game 1-0. So that game in 2017, this was the other trivia I was going to ask you. The third best Bill James game score by an LA Dodger in a loss. Can you name the two with a higher game score?
So I will. A good guess is Kershaw, right?
It is not.
Oh, well, it is a good guess. Give me that. He has lots of games.
Does he? No. Yeah, it is a good guess. I will tell you. I the search that I use for this is so I'll tell you, Rich Hill's game score was 91 in the perfect game the no hitter loss, so I did a search for everything 85 and higher, and in a loss, and this is a team loss. The pitcher didn't necessarily have to lose, but Kershaw did not have any of these games.
So
all of his like high game score games are wins.
I'm gonna tap out because I'm just gonna start naming names. I can't think of a game in particular today.
Okay, so
because this is definitely the one I think of. So
I will say this: the other like sort of safe slash good guess among LA Dodgers, you could have went with Koufax, and he is definitely one. Koufax in 1960 against the Cubs. This was at Wrigley Field. This is funny. Okay, 13 innings, 4 runs, 9 walks, 15 strikeouts. He lost in the 14th with nobody out. Walk off. The other one was Bill Singer, a straight up. He pitched. He didn't lose, but he pitched 9 scoreless innings with 10 strikeouts and 2 hits allowed. Game score. Both of those had game scores of 93. This was 1969. Every other one, like among this, was all Brooklyn people, at least above Rich Hill. Don Drysdale had a game score of 90 in a game the Dodgers lost. 10 innings, no runs. So yeah, these are fun. Okay, so that's sort of it's hard to say like which of those two games do you think is better?
That's got to be
like
better.
I don't even know. I think it's probably the game, I like the no hitter loss in its sort of beauty. It pitched into the 10th, but man, he was so good.
You know what else? Final thing that endears Rich Hill to me.
What?
Any enemy of the Patriots is a friend of mine.
Okay, so that's the other funny part, right? So after Ryu, like, signs with Toronto, we're like, okay. Oh, and then we also have this fun Rich Hill fact to talk about. And so Rich Hill from Boston, he and his wife go to the Patriots game on December 21st. And, like, his wife, I guess, had a backpack or a fanny pack or something that was above the regulations allowed by Gillette Stadium. So they're, like, having an argument with security to the point where, like, they call the police over. And, like, so they both – an argument ensued. Both ended up getting charged with disorderly conduct. His wife, Caitlin, was charged originally with trespassing. Rich Hill was charged with resisting arrest, reduced to lesser violations, and they paid like $1,000 fine. Look, it's kind of funny, right? The lawyer for Rich Hill said this was a terribly unfortunate event that should have never escalated beyond a routine encounter with stadium security. Rich Hill, in a statement, said,
Eric's internet fighting the Patriots, so I'm going to say what Rich Hill said. Or as you put, Dick Mountain said, despite Saturday's events, my great respect for law enforcement remains unchanged. However, seeing my wife handcuffed for a problem that started because of her fanny pack was extremely difficult for me to witness.
I'm completely pro fanny pack, so I'm glad that it's making a comeback. But yeah, and as Andy McCullough tweeted yesterday, we're recording this on a Monday. I guess he tweeted this Saturday, mm-hmm. and the Patriots lost before the AFC championship game for the first time in 9 years. So America rejoiced. And then as Andy McCullough tweeted, the Patriots have not won a playoff game since they arrested Rich Hill. So that don't mess with Rich Hill, I think, is the point of this. And I think that's where we're at. And like, look, so we talked about this, right? Like, the other thing, Rich Hill.
About not messing with Rich Hill.
Yeah. Don't mess with Rich Hill. He's going to be 40 in March. So the next time he starts in a major league game, he'll be 40. There were no 40-year-old pitchers in 2019. So we need a return from this. Bartolo Colon was the last one. He pitched at age 45 in 2018. So, yeah, go old guys is my point here. But, yeah, so now what, right? Because Fernando Rodney, the
eternal.
He's the only pitcher older than Rich Hill, like of any kind in the majors. So
we're going to talk about kind of what the rotation is going to look like in the future. You've got a Dodgers rewind, and we've got some questions, Craig, all that after this. Mentioned it a little earlier, Dodgers rotation, you know, they have 5 starting pitchers who have started a major league game before. So technically, is this rotation done to you? I want a famous Eric Steven percentage on Bueller, Kershaw, Maeda, Urias, and then either May, Stripling, or Gonsolin. Those are your first five starters to start this year, assuming no injury concerns.
Yeah, like, okay, so I think there's increasingly high odds that those a group, five of those seven, will be the Dodgers' like first five starting pitchers of 2020, but it cannot be there. Like, I don't think I don't know how you can honestly like go into like the postseason with that. Like, look, they could have breakout years, whatever, but you can't plan for that. Like, you could. I don't know. It's tough. Like, so I think like it's pretty clear they're going to add someone, whether it's now or whether it's July or something. But I think that's we thought they were going to add a starter like this last offseason or this last trade deadline, or at least, you know, more to adding to the bullpen than they did. And they didn't. So, like, honestly, I don't really know. Like, there's rumors out there, obviously, that the two big sort of trade rumors involving the Dodgers are. One is involving Francisco Lindor with the Indians, and one is involving Mookie Betts with the Red Sox, both because I think especially more so in the Red Sox case because they're already over the tax threshold that, like, they have to get under. And, like, obviously they don't want to trade Betts. He has a year left free agency. And then both have sort of pitchers attached to them and that the Dodgers are interested in. One is David Price with the Red Sox. The other is Mike Clevinger with the Indians. Clevinger is much cheaper than Price. Price was a free agent. He has 3 years and $96 million left. So, like, getting Price would be a boon for the Red Sox in terms of them reducing salary. It doesn't make them better, the Red Sox better, but like, I have no idea the feasibility. It would have to be like the Red Sox being adamant that they have to get under the luxury tax for 2020 or something, to where they'd be like, look, just get rid of Price, send them Betts, and get back what you can, right? Or something like that. That's the sort of desperation move where anything like that would work. The thing with Cleveland is Clevinger is like, he's got three RBIs before free agency. So, still relatively cheap, and then Lindor has 2 years before free agency. So, like, that's going to be like the hugest prospect haul in terms of what you would pay. So, like, I guess I don't know. Most rumors with this say the Indians want Gavin Lux, which is understandable. Dustin May's name also bandied about. Dodgers don't want to trade Gavin Lux, obviously. I think the Cleveland deal seems like a non-starter to me, or like it doesn't seem reasonable. Like, they already traded Corey Kluber, so unless they're also hell-bent on, like, shaving more payroll, but I think they can compete with what they have, so I don't see them necessarily motivated to do that. The Red Sox are probably more motivated to make a move, and maybe even if it's just getting Price, I think that is something that could work for the Dodgers. Like, as of now, the Dodgers are – at the arbitration stuff happens this week. The exchange deadline is Friday, so you'll see a lot of like 1 year deals signed this week. But with the projections and with several assumptions mixed in, the Dodgers are at roughly $165.5 million. The threshold is $208. But man, I think the Red Sox would have to be pretty like desperate or like just hell bent on getting under the cap. It's not even a cap. It's just like an extra cost, right? The other thing, like, I just wanted to bring this up because Dustin Nosler did a lot of work on this, on just the whole offseason he's done this. But, like, he had an article on Dodgers Digest about Jimmy Nelson, who's a free agent. He's also he's coming off, like, a labrum and rotator cuff injuries that cost him all of 2018. He missed the first 2.5 months of 2019 with elbow injury. So, like, he's a total, like, wild card lottery ticket almost at this point. But he was really good in 2017 before he got hurt. So, again, this is, like, much lower level. But, like, that's sort of, like, the options, at least, that I see. There's probably more options out there. I don't really know. But, like, that's where we're sort of getting it. So maybe that's why the Dodgers might say, let's wait until July. But it's, like, that's a risky move. especially with like just heading into the offseason with this maneuverability or with this room to spend, and they just don't have something to spend it on right now. So I'll say this, the reason, and this is sort of like notable, Bill Plaschke talked to Stan Kasten over the weekend, and it was a pretty good column. Like, Kasten, understandably, like, defensive in a lot of the questions Plaschke asked about, like, the TV deal, and, you know, you're getting all this money from the TV deal, why don't you spend? And his deal, and Kasten's basic response was, like, we've had $200 million payrolls, like, you can't, you know, possibly, like, it's hard to like knock that, and on a some level I get it, but we've talked about this before. It's like the Dodgers finally get to the at the point where they're like clearly a championship contender, and they don't like, they just like the last two off seasons have been kind of a dud, right? Like, mm-hmm. they didn't really add a ton, and like you just think like that little marginal something to get them over the hump might help, and so that's where the frustration
even
lies. Yeah.
I think there's something to be said by doing, like, I think where a lot of in our the article Kasten was kind of getting at is fans want us to make these moves to feel better, not necessarily because they're going to be the ones that win a championship. And a lot of times it's the less heralded deals that are actually going to win that championship. And I get that. But similar to the points we made when both times Kershaw's come up for an extension, sometimes you need to make these moves to make the fans feel a little bit more engaged. And he countered that by saying, oh, ticket sales are really high, everyone's coming out. We have metrics that say that most fans are really happy with what we're doing. I don't buy that. I don't know. The interview is kind of weird because I'm angry at both Stan and Plaschke at different points in this interview. Why can't Plaschke quote himself? This always bothered me by Plaschke interviews. He direct quotes who he's interviewing, but then he like cleans up what his question was. Really bothers me.
Oh, but well, then I kind of get that. You're like, it's not necessarily a Q&A, right? You're not printing a Q&A.
I get it. It always makes Plaschke come out cleaner and like the quotes he gets from Stan are clearly kind of more off the cuff. I don't know. It's always bothered me.
Well, about the Plaschke I will say this. Plaschke's telling the story. So like he's writing, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Like that's not that big of a deal unless you're like literally just posting a Q&A or something. But okay. So I will say this, I took from this, from Stan Kasten, it says the team we have now is not going to be the team we have to start the postseason. I expect that this team this year, it looks like we're going to be well over the CBT or someone over. Now, we talked about this. They're at 165.5 now. Threshold's 208. So another one. To do that, like, you got to do some stuff, right? Like, so. Like,
Joe Kelly, this season, Rays.
Yeah. Or, yeah, but are they going to renegotiate? Like, yeah. So, I don't know. Like, it's interesting. I mean, it's like this weird, like hint of like it, you know, like he's, it's like it's such a tease, like, man, like you, I don't
because
know
if you looking at free agents, there's not a lot, like not a lot of like, so when you have that number, the 165, yeah. numbers, how many like actual holes are on that roster?
Well, so right now, like, okay, so there's, they have a complete offense, like the it's going to be a 26 man roster this year.
That's right.
So, and it's, you can't carry, I think, more than 13 pitchers. So they've always carried 13 pitchers with the 25 man roster. So it's going to be 13 and 13, and they have their 13. Like, they have basically, if you like, I would say Matt Beatty has a good shot of being the other guy. I have him as the 14th guy right now. Right. So like, I'm just going to run down the list for sake of completeness, as it stands right now: Will Smith, catcher; Muncy at first; Lux at second; Turner at third; Seager at short; Pollock in left; Bellinger center; Peterson in right. Okay, Alex Verdugo dealing with a back injury, so I guess there's where Beatty comes in if needed. But it's still, it's January, so Verdugo, Kike, Chris Taylor, Austin Barnes, backup catcher, and then that's your 13. So Beatty's the one right after that, and Rios right after that. So that's the 13. The pitching staff we mentioned, they have those seven pitchers. Kershaw, Buehler, Maeda, Urias, and May. There's your five, just to name five. Your bullpen is Jansen, Trinan, Baez, Kelly for sure. Kolarik, even though they might not use him when they should, every game they should, that's five. You figure Ross Stripling is going to be in the rotation or the bullpen, so that's seven. Scott Alexander, possibly again. So, like, it's one of those pitchers is going to be the eighth reliever. So you're basically a set team and a pretty good team, but like you could see where they need to sort of like make improvements, and that's so like they, you're right, they don't have to do something, but it's clear that they like want to make an impact, but it's just a matter of where.
Yeah, and how. Like, there's, if you look at the available free agent, there's like Josh Donaldson, who they've been like lukewarmly linked to, and then you just have to jettison either in trade or just by designating to a bench role one of your other starting position players. Yep. And then it's like who is the best free agent starting pitcher left out like outside of, I know you mentioned Jimmy Nelson, but I don't even
he's
know.
Not even, he's a lottery ticket. And like, yeah that's exactly. A good, yeah. That's a good question.
So like, the only way you can do this is by trading by doing something like this Betts price deal. And
right.
That would be great. That would be really exciting, but I think a lot of fans are just getting a lot. And again, and I think Stan called it the Twitterverse, but a lot of fans that are actually paying attention, not just the fans that are kind of going casually to a game and they can name 5 or 10 players. The fans that are paying attention and reading, whether it's ESPN or MLB Trade Rumors, however they get it, they're sick of reading Andrew Friedman saying we're going after elite talent, and then they make one signing of a reliever and that's kind of it.
Right. And like, so I'm just perusing as an example the MLB Trade Rumors top 50 free agents from the beginning of the season. Like Donaldson, Ozuna, Nick Castellanos, all position players. And then Daniel Hudson at number 28, breaking news while we're talking here, he's going back with the Nationals on a 2-year deal. So he's out. But like, we haven't got to a starting pitcher yet, like that's still available. I'm looking at this. Good Lord. So like, oh, okay. You know who's the top rated pitcher on here, starting pitcher on here?
Yeah.
Alex Wood.
Oh.
Number 39. So like, even that, like, and part of the reason like the Dodgers traded him is because they didn't really trust him like to be like healthy enough or have good enough stuff. Like they were down on him sort of starting in the playoffs after 2017. So like, that doesn't seem like something that they're like that interested in bringing him back, right?
So in the name of hitting the CBT, Alex Wood, 1 year, $50 million.
Right. Yeah, it's one of those like, yeah, we have to hit the minimum. That would be an amazing contract. Can you imagine? Like, oh my God, that would be funny. So yeah, so like I don't really know, but like it's clear like they have to do something. So they have, like we mentioned, they have an extra spot on the 40 man right now because JT Chargrave was released, so he's going to be with the Rakuten Eagles. So what do you know?
All right, we're running a little long on time, so we're just gonna go to the Dodgers rewind.
Okay, so we mentioned the list before of the top Dodgers ERA plus with 50 or more starts. Ryu is tied for 6th at 129. Hill is tied for 9th at 128. So there's a bunch of people lumped together there in the bottom half of the top 10. Rich Hill is tied with Whit Wyatt. He pitched 6 years for the Brooklyn Dodgers, basically just before or during World War II, 1939 to 1944. I thought this was interesting. Whit is short for Whitlow. Whitlow Wyatt, that's an awesome name. Okay, so Wyatt pitched for like 9 years in the American League, and like I was reading his Sabre bio, and like they thought of him as like a failure. This is a quote from Wyatt. I wasn't going any place. I wasn't making progress. I thought, well, I'll just give up and I'll stay home and farm. he's a guy from Georgia. He was married at this point. So his age 30 season, he goes to the minors, and this was the Milwaukee Brewers. Back then, they were in the American Association. He won 23 games, and he added, reading his bio, he honed his curve, and then they said he needed to add a second pitch or another pitch, so he added like an even slower
curve. This is a Rich Hill story.
Just sounds great. That's like, you're right. It basically is. So like, So in the American League in 9 years, he had more walks than strikeouts, 323 walks, 322 strikeouts. With the Dodgers, 305 walks, but 540 Ks. So like a completely new pitcher. He pitched two complete games in the 1941 World Series. He won game two. He lost game five. He had a 250 ERA. He was very good. When the Dodgers got Wyatt, like, they were a bad team. Like, they hadn't made the World Series. It was only the World Series back then. Like, they made the World Series in 1920. They were really bad for, like, the next 20 years. He wasn't obviously solely responsible. They got, like, Pee Wee Reese came along. They had a bunch of good players. They were getting good. So, like, that was part of it. He was really good. He ended up, like, after his playing career, he was a pitching coach for over a decade with the Phillies and Braves. And then he moved back to Georgia when the Braves moved to Atlanta in 1966. So good for him. Whit Wyatt, one of the sort of forgotten really good pitchers in Dodgers history.
We have questions from Craig to get to, but we're going to talk a little bit about both True BLA, the podcast, and the site in the wake of Vox's announcement regarding California sites. Both of those after this. We've been fighting internet issues throughout this episode. I'll probably have to start the episode at a little preamble. So hopefully we're going to be able to get through this because we have a lot to cover, some important stuff. You know way more about it than I do. I am affected, but sort of in a weird indirect way after Vox announced that it was removing the contractor positions for any California-related sites. So I'm going to let you kind of explain it and kind of explain to our listeners what it means for both True BLA, the podcast, and the site.
Yeah, so like this, as you can imagine, hits both of us rather personally. Like the future of like the site, True Blue LA itself, but also the podcast. When we last recorded, it was December 16th. That was the morning that all this sort of came out. I did not have any like advance notice of this. Not that I should have or have been privy to it, but like it all sort of the timing of it was very odd. And like when we recorded last, we were like an hour into hearing the news, didn't really know a ton.
And a lot of the news from my perspective was very focused on, rightfully, on writers, because that's what the law sort of directly affected and what Vox's announcement directly affected. So I was getting emails about how does this relate to podcasts while we were recording and we were trying to figure it out.
Yeah, so irony of ironies, that was our 35th episode of 2019, and the new California law that goes into effect on January 1st limits contractors to 35 submissions per year. The underlying philosophy behind that, I think, is that if you work more than that, you're an employee and you should be given the benefits that employees have. Contractors don't often have benefits or very rarely do. So it sort of has a lot of side effects. One of those is SB Nation, like the team site model is all contractors basically. And this is huge because SB Nation, has 23, team sites in California. This is MLB, NBA, NFL, NHL, MLS, and the college sites. So 23 team sites, it's over 200 contractors affected. It's also, in a weird way, like it's not just those California team sites. Like the person who ran Mavs Moneyball, the Dallas Mavericks team site, lives in California, so she's affected. Jacob Birch, who your podcast co-host here, he works on a California site but lives in Kansas City. He's affected. Catherine Cottle, one of our moderators, and Catherine the Blue on in the comment section is a moderator, and like she's affected. She lives out of state, so it has a wide reaching effect. So it's over 200 people essentially, like by the end of March, aren't going to have paid positions anymore. I guess the option is there for many to, if you want to stay on and be like a sort of contributor, but not a paid one, that's for people who don't get hired. Now here's the deal. So this is like something that SB Nation is sort of, trying out, in this for the California sites. It's pretty clear that this law could probably be in effect in other sites. So maybe sort of setting the framework of what to do with future sites, because they have over 300 team sites in the network. So, but on one level, so you have over 200 contractors affected by this. Their SB Nation is hiring roughly 20 positions. I haven't got an exact number, but I'm pretty sure that's the number. I don't know how many of those are full-time and how many are part-time, but I would say over half are going to be full-time, maybe. And so just by basic math, you notice I didn't say 23 positions. So by definition, there's fewer new paid employees than California team sites. So it's clear that several people are going to have roles on multiple sites. Now that we don't know exactly what the structure is going to be, but like it could mean like one person is sort of producing content and or running things at both True Blue LA and Halo's Heaven, just as an example. I don't know this to be the case. I don't have any inside info on this. I'm just telling you sort of how the system works. And all the contractors, basically, their contracts are going to run out in the first few months of 2020. And then after March, then this sort of new system will be in place. I've seen a few people who've been hired. Brady Kopfer, he basically runs the Golden State of Mind and McCovey Chronicles. Now he's going to write, Giants and Warriors stuff. So that's sort of one way they're doing it. So it might not necessarily be cross baseball sites, but maybe like cross sports, if that makes sense. We don't really know who's all been hired yet, or I think the process is still ongoing. But like as you might imagine, this like affects all of us. I'm an employee of Vox now, and I work on technically SBNation.com. I have not haven't been paid for my True Blue LA work in 2019. I wrote 1 week in review like every week on the site for the season, but I did that because like it was an old habit of mine, and I didn't get paid any extra for doing that. I haven't been getting paid for the podcast because they have a policy of not you can't collect like stipends or contractor stuff if you're an employee. So that's a thing. As with any people, for a lot of us, a labor of love. We're not doing this to get rich. And Jacob has a full-time job that he does on the side. This is a very much a labor of love for him.
Like you're making, my full-time job is what's on the side.
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah.
Yeah, it's on the side. This is what matters. And yeah, I do get paid. Or did as I mentioned, the podcasting stuff is still a little nebulous. There's some guesses as to some of the money that goes to me, which then goes a lot of it goes to microphones. I'm still paying a few services, even though SB Nation hosts the main podcast. There's still a few services I'm using. So some of that money's going away. Some of it's not. We're not exactly quite sure. I imagine it'll get kind of shored up as we get into February and March.
Yeah. And so I have a few thoughts just generally. I am an employee of Vox. I mean, they're not like, as far as I know, not really putting the clamps down on what we can say and what we can't say. I don't think I'm talking out of school in any of this. I will say this. On one hand, first off, the idea that they are hiring actual full and part-time writers to be actual employees with actual benefits, that's like long overdue. That's something that kind of had to happen.
And I think it was the intent of this law, right?
Exactly, right. And so it's how companies deal with it is sort of the thing. Mm-hmm. But like just as an example, right? Like the team site model, here's what we were dealing with for. So I ran True Blue LA for almost 10 seasons. It was 9 full seasons and then half of the 10th season in 2018. During that time, the most I ever made as a site manager was $1,000 a month. I was also from mid or late 2012. I had some other role, or actually I also ran the regional sites, a regional site of SB Nation Los Angeles.
starting in 2010. But as, I was a, I worked in some level with like SBNation.com since August of 2012. So I was doing concurrent things. And from a, like just a perspective, I made most of my money doing the .com stuff while, and then I also did True Blue LA on the side. So, and then in 2018, I went from contractor to employee and then sort of folded into more of a national employee as opposed to a team site runner. So that's when that sort of went away. But anyway, so just $1,000 a month. By rough count, during my time at True Blue LA, I had roughly 14,000 posts. Now,
Slacker.
Yeah, not that's a rough count. Like some of that is like literally making a game stream, so it's not like not everyone was grueling. These weren't all 1,000-word essays or whatever. So, like that's 123 a month for 10 years. That's 4 posts a day. And so like you do the math on what like the like hourly wage of that is. So to give you an idea of what sort of the standard was before. The other thing is eliminating contractors altogether is a gut punch, right? Like the law says you can have a be contractor and not especially if you can't pronounce it right, like I just couldn't, but but you can have a contractor and not and just have, you know, 35 or fewer submissions a year. But it sounds like this sort of program they're instituting for the California sites is a company decision, like to sort of see how this works out, right? So I don't know. I mean, look, none of this is has been like fully finalized in terms of what they're going to do, but to not have any contractors at all, I think they'll have some sort of budget for freelance things. So maybe that's how like you get through it. But in terms of like eliminating all the contractor spots, like that seems a little harsh. I think most people who wrote for the team sites have day jobs elsewhere, and maybe they weren't spending as much time as say I was doing team site stuff, and this was just extra money that they got to have an outlet for something they're passionate about. And I think to shut off that valve is short-sighted, I think. But like, you know, we'll see how this goes. I hope that hasn't fully closed like off anything. Not to mention, well, we still aren't exactly sure how the podcasting is going to work.
Yeah.
But we'll see. But then the other thing was like not getting the contractors like not getting any notice was pretty terrible. Like we didn't know till that morning, but like. It's one thing to say like, look, this is the new law coming in, our hands were tied, but the law was passed in September, right? And like, so this went out on December 16th, a public post saying, thank you, California, was the headline, which I probably could have workshopped that headline a little bit, essentially saying that we're eliminating all the contractor positions, maybe not advised. That went out at the same time as contractors email to contractors went out, like saying, here's what's going to happen with your thing. So that was, you know, something that's not cool. You feel for the people like affected by that. So the other thing is, and I've explained this or tried to explain this to people I've talked to in the company about this. The one thing that you're that's at stake here is the actual community of the site themselves. That's what really makes the site. Obviously the content is key, and having it's not just like drivel and crap on the site. You want to have good content, but if you don't have like a community there to like share it and interact, then what do you really have? And like if you're like stretching everybody thin to the point where different people are running multiple sites, and I wonder how they are going to replace all the contributions of all the contractors with so few people. Maybe it works, maybe it doesn't, I don't know. I think that's what part of this sort of figuring out process is going to be. But like, I hope that they keep the community in mind to like keep those standards up that the community is used to. And you have to sort of, have that in mind when you're making these changes. If you lose the community, you have nothing. So And if you put a substandard product out, it's gonna they're gonna go away, and that's trouble. So what does that mean for us personally? I last year at some point I went through, because I was wondering exactly how many of these I did. So I've done 11 years. I started the week in reviews in 2009. That was my first year of games on the site. I started doing weekly reviews, and so there's been 291 seasonal weeks. Since then, I've done 288 of the reviews. There were a couple times when I was out, when I was in the hospital in 2017, I believe Ryan and or Craig took the mantle on those, but only missed 3 in 11 years. My goal is to keep doing those. I have no idea who's going to be like the lead dog or the head honcho at running True Blue LA when the season starts, but my goal is to keep doing that. We also, Jacob and I, we're going to keep doing the podcast basically as long as they let us. And so and we want to look, like you said, this is a labor of love for us. We want to keep doing it. If it comes to a point where we don't have the option to keep doing the podcast on True Blue LA, we thought about possibly moving it to Patreon. So I would appreciate, I'll put this in the show notes too, but is that something you guys are interested in? Because we think we do a pretty good job. Is there something more you want to hear on the podcast? Let us know, because we want to keep doing the podcast, and it would just be getting enough subscribers to cover actual costs of the server, some of the software, etc.
And an
editor. Right. And an editor. Exactly right. So we're not looking to break the bank on this. That said, we will not turn down breaking the bank on this. if we happen to have, if there are millions of you, and we've seen the numbers, there aren't millions. There's several dozens of you. But yeah, so let us know if that's something you're interested in. But we want to keep doing it. We're not going anywhere. So yeah, that's sort of where we're at. And there's a lot of confusion right now, and understandable anger from some of the community itself. But we'll see how it goes. We all love the sort of community at True Blue LA, and you're a big reason why we do the podcast. So we want to hear from you about what do you think. So thank you, everybody. I think that's sort of our plan. But yeah, that's what I think going forward.
Yeah, I got nothing to add. I guess I'll mention it before. We'll probably have a better idea of the lay of the land, specifically in regards to the podcast. I'm guessing sometime in February and March, I'll probably follow up with the folks at SB Nation, just get an idea of where we stand with, do we still have an editor? Are we limited to 35 episodes? That's the mandate we have right now. I could see that changing, because I don't know if it's considered a contribution in the same way that the law indicates. Everything's a little bit fluid. But once we have a better idea, I think we'll have a better idea from them. We'll have a better idea of what we're going to be doing with the podcast, and if we needed to change anything, either small or big, we'll probably do that right around the time the season starts. Isn't that great?
Yay!
So we have out with the new, in with the old. There we go. Out with the new news, but in with the old tradition on this podcast of
questions from Craig.
You have five questions from Craig, who we got, who also was at Dim Sum with us.
Yeah, it's another. We would have been able to knock out so much had we just had room to put a microphone and a recording device near the table enough to capture us. But we would have been interrupted by chewing and etc. So it would have been good.
Slurping would have been delicious. Question the first. You have it as A. Question the A. As of 7:53 a.m. Pacific Standard Time, the Dodgers have not made a trade for Mookie Betts or Francisco Lindor, as you may have mentioned already in the podcast. With the arbitration deadline being Friday, do you think the deadline has any impact on these potential deals?
So I can update you for now. As of 3:34 p.m. Pacific Time, there also hasn't been any Dodgers trade. In fact, what's funny, so Jeff Passan, the Nationals re-signed Daniel Hudson and 2 years, $11 million. So Passan put out a thing about like the top spending teams, and like nine teams had spent $100 million or more. And then like the next highest was like the Rangers at $50 million in free agency. And then obviously the Dodgers are at $10 million, and he put out the bottom list too. So 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. The Dodgers are tied for 11th least amount of free agent spending. Not that they necessarily had to be top free agent spenders, and yes, they did offer that big offer to Cole, which was not successful. But that's sort of where we're at right now in this offseason, as we've talked about. Like, we're just sort of in the waiting process. So, Mookie Betts, this Friday is the exchange deadline. A lot of teams are filing trial, in that if you don't reach an agreement by Friday, they're just going to go to an arbitration hearing at some point in February, no matter what. So this, it essentially sets a soft deadline to sort of make these deals. However, in terms of the trade talks, I don't think it really affects it. You know pretty much what Mookie's going to make in 2020. Like, for instance, like by Friday, if say, like, I think the projection for him is like, I think $27.7 million or something, which would be a record. But like, it's going to be to a point where if he submits a figure of like $31 million and the Red Sox are like at $26 million, and sure, they might gravitate toward the midpoint and make a deal, but like, you're not going to not trade for Betts because, oh man, we could have afforded like $28 million, but can we really add on $31 million? No, it's Mookie Betts. You're going to take him no matter what. So I don't think it really affects it. It's more of a deadline. We're going to see a lot of like contracts reached this week. The Dodgers have a ton of arbitration people, and we have a standing bet.
I lost
of a few of those. Yeah, you picked the third, which was crazy, and so we'll see more deals as the week rolls along. But Dodgers have a slew of arbitration eligible players, so I predict every single one will be either signed or dealt with in some fashion by next Friday.
Eric Karros is the only LA Dodger that hit more than 200 home runs, 211, in a decade, and that was in the 90s. Will Cody Bellinger become the second LA Dodger to do that?
Okay, so first off, like, just that first sentence alone was like shocking to me. And like, I know like the Dodgers don't have like many homers. They've only had like 7 players hit 200 homers ever, right? That includes all the Brooklyn people. But like, still, like, 200 home runs in a decade, it's not that many, right? I mean, it's 20 a year if you play the entire decade, and like, that's an accomplishment. But it's like, they've only had one since moving to LA, and I'm like, okay, I guess it makes sense, right? Like, but like, so if you just break it down, like the LA people, Ron Say and Steve Garvey are both over 200 with the Dodgers, and like, but both of those were like split a lot in the 70s and then a few years in the 80s for both. Ron Say hit 163 home runs in the 70s, Garvey 159, and their totals were 228, 211 with the Dodgers. So Matt Kemp, he hit 220 home runs in the 2010s, and he's interesting because he entered the 2010s 1 year older than Cody Bellinger is now. Was his MVP season didn't come till 2011, so he wasn't like coming off what Bellinger's coming off, and also a different era and all. But Kemp hit 220 home runs in the 2010s. Only 142 of those came with the Dodgers, and it was in 6 years, but not consecutive, because he had the weird 5 years in, traded back, traded again. Like, this is a weird decade for Matt Kemp, man. Like, but like that. He hit 220 home runs. So from, and I looked, so Mike Piazza did not hit 200 home runs with the Dodgers, but he hit 177, and he only played 5 1/4 seasons. He was going to be a free agent at the end of 1998. And when it was clear that he wasn't going to re-sign, the Dodgers traded him. But interestingly enough, he hit 23 home runs with the rest of the season in 1998 after getting traded. So he would have ended his, like, had he stayed with the Dodgers and had the same production, he would have ended with exactly 200. I thought that was interesting. So the three Brooklyn folks who were all above 200 all hit 200 home runs in the 50s. Roy Campanella was at 211. And of course, only in 8 years because he was paralyzed at the end of 1957. And he did not play when the Dodgers moved to Los Angeles. Gil Hodges hit 310 home runs in the 50s. He was a stalwart at first base. Very productive year after year. Duke Snider hit 326 home runs in the 50s. He had also 5 straight years of 40 home runs, so he had the 200 in a 5-year span, let alone a 10. So getting back to the question about Bellinger, like, it's easy to just say yes, right? Because
that's
you
what
think,
I'm doing.
Right. And so, but then, like, weird things happen, man. Like, but then again, Bellinger could also get to 200 probably faster, given, like, the era. Like, he already is at, what, 111, I think, or something like that. So he's averaged, like, 37 a year in his first 3 years, and he's still super young. He only, but the thing is, he only has 3 more years till free agency. So, like, and, like, look, he could leave. He very much could leave, or the Dodgers could trade him before free agency, all this stuff. We don't know. But I think he's the most likely. Like, it would be hilarious to me if Max Muncy does it, because, like, he not only stays a Dodger, but then they sign him, and then he just keeps staying on. And then, like, he ends up with, like, a 250 home run decade or something, like, all with the Dodgers. Like, that would be, like, a funny, like, unexpected thing. But I think it, of all the Dodgers, like, he's probably the easiest to say yes, even though he does technically only have 3 years. If Matt Kemp were to challenge Barry Bonds' home run record for 3 consecutive years, he could get all 200 in the next 3 years. So it's not out of the question that even if he leaves as a free agent after 2022, that he could have a 200 home run decade with the Dodgers. So I'm going to say a very tentative yes.
And we'll see what happens. You know, he could, it's possible that he has sort of a downward trend, but if he keeps being kind of the, maybe the average Cody Bellinger that we've seen over the last 3 seasons, I have a hard time seeing the Dodger front office not kind of Kershawing him and just saying, this is our franchise guy. This is who we're going to go out of our way to make sure it sticks around. So I expect him to do it. But like you said, weird stuff happens. It's baseball.
And look, I think back to this, going back to Matt Kemp, directly after the 2011 season with Kemp.
Yeah, he's who I had in mind when I said weird stuff happens.
You cannot imagine Matt Kemp not being a Dodger at that point, right?
Yep.
Especially since they also just signed him to that 8-year, $160 million. You're like, well, clearly a Dodger for life. Yep. Like, I wrote a post about, like, all the – what he has to do over the 8-year contract to set various Dodgers records. Guess how many of those he actually set?
0.
None. So who knows, man? Baseball's weird.
The last time the Dodgers had fewer than 61 starts from left-handed pitchers was in 2010, when they had 44. Kershaw had 32, and Ted Lilly had 12. With just Kershaw and Urias projected to start games for the 2020 Dodgers, will the Dodgers have more than 50 starts from left-handed pitchers this season?
So, you know, we have Urias in there, but of course, you never know exactly what's going to happen with Urias because, you know, it's all something always happens, right? He's definitely not going to be, like, I don't think he's, no matter what, I don't think he's going to qualify for the ERA title this year. I don't think he's going to make 25 starts because, maybe he might make 25, but that'd be a lot. And so Kershaw, they've been, like, a little careful with him, like, easing off at times. Like, he made 29 starts this last year. So let's put Kershaw at, like, 28, right? Just say 28. So do they have somewhere to get the other 22? And I'm not sure I would bet on Urias filling the gap to get the 50. The only thing that makes me say yes is because obviously it opens up the field to pitchers they might acquire, and David Price is left-handed. Not that we get back to that again, but, like, there's other pitchers too. And maybe they sneak their way in by doing some weird opener thing with like an Adam Kolarik or Scott Alexander one inning thing, like midseason or something, if they're, I don't know. Who knows? But I think I will take the over just because I'm almost just interested to see how they do it.
I'll take the over.
So, yeah, I'll take
the over. I'm going to change the question because I'm going to change it to how high I had actually originally read this when I was thinking of my answer. Do they get to 61?
No.
Okay, cool. You and I are on the same page then. I had read this as the same number as 61. So I was like, I was very prepared to say, no, they won't get to it. But I think 50 can happen. Like you said, just weird stuff can happen.
If they trade for someone and get to 61, will it be a 61 with an asterisk?
Will the White Sox win more games than the Cubs in the upcoming 2020 season? That's the fourth question.
So I was looking at this. The White Sox have been super active. They signed Yasmani Grandal to a big deal. They signed Dallas Keuchel to a big deal. They re-signed Jose Abreu at first base. They traded for Nomar Mazara. They're looking pretty strong. Their pitching staff was very bad outside of Lucas Giolito. You get Grandal, you're stealing more strikes. You figure that'll have a multiplier effect on the pitching staff, plus adding Keuchel. So I think they're definitely going to be better. That said, there's a big gap like between those two teams. Like the White Sox certainly are younger and on the rise, and the Cubs not necessarily so. So the White Sox won 72 games. The Cubs won 84. The Cubs' Pythagorean record was 90-72. The White Sox had a Pythagorean 69 wins. So gap's even bigger there. I think the White Sox are on the rise. I think
the Cubs also just underperformed, even in concerning Pythagorean, not just luck wise. They just weren't as good of a team as maybe they could have been. Just maybe some luck issues, weird things going on. So I do not think so. I think the Cubs will still win more games.
Yeah, that said, like the White Sox are, I think, going to be better. Mm-hmm. And the way you could say they might is that just the AL Central is worse.
That's true.
Than the NL Central. So like, that said, the Twins and the Indians are still like playoff caliber type teams. So it's not like a cakewalk, right? Like so it'll be tough. But yeah, so I think the White Sox, not quite the Cubs yet. Like, who knows? What if they, like, swoop in and get Josh Donaldson or something? Like, okay, then we could start, like, entertaining. Or who knows? But, like, they're getting there. But just, I don't think they're just there yet.
Final question. Food question. And then the last thing you cooked at home that was previously frozen.
Okay, so.
So this is a strange. Like, I think I'm gonna slightly restructure this question. Because I'm going to rule two kinds of foods out. Melissa and I routinely go to Costco, buy a bunch of chicken breasts, and then freeze those. Or we make them up for our sous vide machine and then freeze them. I'm not counting that. Food like that, fresh, that you're freezing for preservation's sake. I'm also not counting ice cream.
Oh, yeah, that's totally understandable.
So
any dessert, right?
How about, like, I'm here. I've got here. I'm going to non-ice cream thing that you bought from the frozen section and you ate. How about that?
I had an answer for this. Like, no matter what, it was a Kroger brand 3-meat pizza.
Mm-hmm.
That I bought like a week ago and I ate over the weekend and it was fine. It was like $3.
There are two frozen pizza products of my childhood. One of which readily available here in Kansas City area. One of which I have seen in a very rare occasion. Bagel Bites are what are available everywhere here. And you know what's great about Bagel Bites, Eric?
Besides everything?
No, when pizza's on a bagel, you can have pizza anytime. And I do.
Oh, okay.
But I was, as we've mentioned, I just got back from visiting my family in L.A. And when I'm in L.A., I make sure to seek out the Celeste pizza. Because that was really the frozen pizza of my youth. So when I'm back home, I always buy like four. And they're always like four for $5 at the local Vons. And I always get four and have it over the course of a week.
Are you a Rockefeller? Because I literally have, I think, four mini Celeste pizzas in my fridge right now. I mean, in my freezer right now. And I paid 88 cents a piece for those. So
wow.
Suck on that.
Yeah, it's the Santa Clarita way. Always overcharging.
That's right.
On the other end of things, what about canned? What was the last canned thing? I don't eat canned food.
Okay, so the
and that's not because it's canned. It's just like a lot. Like, I don't like beans, for instance. I don't like canned vegetables generally. So pineapple, that might have been the last thing I had that was canned.
So the best part about this question, I'm so glad you instinctively split them up because, as written, like Craig's question says, like the last thing you cooked at home that was previously frozen and that was canned, and I'm thinking that is specific, man. Like
I think I'm asking what he intended.
I think so too, but like I was just thinking, I'm like, what, like flash frozen shrimp, like into a can? Like my mind was reeling. I was like, okay. But yeah, so canned for me, and you cooked, right? So it's not tuna. But I don't, I haven't, it's been a little, a few weeks since there, probably a month since I had tuna. For me, I'm pretty sure it is soup. I have a decent amount of like, just as a sort of like, you know, quick fix sort of thing, where if I don't feel like making a dinner or something, or I'll just heat up soup, a can of soup, and eat that. And so I'm pretty sure it was like, I'm trying to think of the exact kind. It was probably, it was possibly a beef and potato. I'm not sure, but I'm certain it was soup, and probably like 2 weeks ago, I think.
I also don't like soup, so that also explains my lack of candy. I will say, not, go ahead.
Do you like chili?
I do like chili, and therefore some of those, like the tomatoes, come from that. But if you know beans about chili, Eric, you know chili has no beans, so no components there. So yeah, I will, but I'll leave that to Chicole. What's out? The best meal I've ever had from a canned is from the Montreal's Au Pied de Cochon, and it's a duck in a can, which is the duck and meat and foie gras all get put in a can and then cooked on the stovetop, and they bring the can out to your table and uncan it and plop it on your table, and it's delicious.
That sounds really good.
It's really good. I'll see if I can find a video of it for you.
You know what I'm gonna do tonight? I'm gonna heat up some soup from a can, and then I'm gonna polish it off with the Celeste pizza.
Oh, that's the way to do it.
Living the high life. This episode took a long time to record because of my internet issues, and thank you everybody for listening. Let us know about what you think. Are you interested if we ended up doing branching out to a Patreon? Would that be something you would still listen to? Let us know. Thank you for listening, and we will talk to you in a couple weeks.